Welcome back to Tangential Banter. My name is Ben Mowell, and I'm here with my co-host, Jack Korzenowski.
What's the haps, y'all?
What's the haps?
I don't know why I said that.
I was going to say, is that a saying? Is that just what your brain came up with in the moment?
It is. I'm not good on my feet. Don't tell any future job interviewers that, though.
I feel like you've already let that one out of the bag in a previous episode.
Probably. I can never remember what I have or haven't said. I can't even remember what I don't know all of our episodes that we've done because I listen to my podcasts on Pocket Casts.
Okay.
Which is like an app, but I don't think we can get ours on there.
I should check.
Or at least we don't. Because I've been actually meaning to like go back and listen to them. One, just to recap, you know, what have we talked about? Just so that I know and I can catch up on that so we don't talk about the same thing second time. But also just to see, you know, how do I sound? Is there any changes I can make? Am I being too boisterous and aggressive? Or am I too meek and reserved? I don't think it's that one, but...
So I'm looking at our stats on the Anchor app right now, and we actually have listeners from 9 countries outside of the U.S.
Wow.
And that could just be part of an episode here or there, right? But
we're international.
We're international, yep.
Did you say nine listeners outside the U.S. or 9? There are listeners in 9 different countries.
Yes, that one.
Ooh. So there's at least 9 listeners. Or at least
at least 9 people have listened to part of an episode in 9 countries. At least a person has. And as I'm looking at our who listens where, since you mentioned, was it Pocket Cast?
Pocket Cast.
Right now, 93% of our listens are on Spotify. This is for the last 30 days, I guess. We got 3% on Apple Podcasts and 3% on Anchor.
Does it say how many people have actually listened?
It does if I go episode by episode. It looks like at the moment we've got like 4 or 5 people who are listening to the episodes new when they come out, and then a few more kind of check in throughout the week.
Almost in the double digits.
I mean, if we're... Non-zero counts as almost in double digits, then yes. And to answer your question, we can get Pocket Casts. So we can set it up, but I think we're connected to Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. We can also get Stitcher, Radio Public, Pocket Casts, CastBox, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, and Overcast.
That's a lot.
And Spotify. So there's quite a few, yeah.
How many would you say? 10 million?
No, not 10 million. But it's quite a few. What is that? 3, 6, 9. 10. 10 platforms in addition to Anchor. So if you listen to podcasts somewhere else, it better be one of those or we can't get you this podcast.
Alas.
Okay, so pivoting to our topic for today. This one is pretty interesting. The thought occurred to me, or it came up in conversation a couple of months ago, that our world today is pretty obsessed with professional sports. And people in those sports have this kind of enchanted life. Or it seems that way from the outside, where, you know, they have fame and fortune and things that so many people aspire to. Whether or not you actually aspire to those things, there are many who do. But they also have to do a lot of work behind the scenes, and we only see just, you know, kind of the tip of the iceberg of all the effort that they put in. And so the topic for today is just kind of this thought exercise of what would the world look like if there was that level of visibility and public attention on the work of everyday people just going about their life. So we were talking a little bit about, you know, what would it look like if you were at a meeting at work and every meeting you come out of, you know, there's a press corps and they're asking questions about like, oh, so what do you think the key decision was or the key takeaway is from that meeting? It'd answer all these questions. Or, you know, if people were watching you with video cameras do your job and then critiquing what you did well and what you didn't do well, you know, that kind of stuff. How much would it change what we do, or would it give us any perspective on what professional athletes deal with on a regular basis?
There'd be a lot more, like, they'd have to have ESPN 306 to cover everything.
Well, I think that raises probably the first reason why it doesn't happen is that you have to have enough people to have an audience, right? And even if it was interesting to watch, we can't all be watching each other work and then being watched at the same time. Like, it's numerically, you've got to have more people watching than participating in the activity.
It just struck me too, because being a sports journalist, or like, you know, being a part of the people covering the sports, that's a job. So there would have to be people covering sports, where it's just, yes, like, you know, there's a press conference for the people who are holding the press conference. You know what I mean? It's like the game ends, there's a press conference, the players come out. So, you know, how did you think so-and-so did about this? Well, we could have done better here, there, you know, next week we're going to do X, Y, and Z. Okay. And then the journalists, you know, get up, walk over to the next room, go to their podium. And then there are other journalists saying, hey, John, we saw that you raised your hand and they answered one of your questions. Did you have a second question you wanted to ask? Yeah, I did. But, you know, I just, you know, next week I'm going to be more assertive and get my hand up there earlier and higher, and we'll see how well that works.
And then to go along with that, you'd have to have like the, I think one of the things that came to my mind was like the talk shows that follow, right? So there's like,
oh, yeah,
the event itself, and then there's the press conference, and then there are the talk shows debating the outcome of, you know, who did well in the game, like what are the major storylines, what came out of the press conference, blah, blah, blah. So then on top of that, it'd be, yeah, you'd now have a talk show where it's like, man, Jack asked a really interesting question in that press conference. No, I disagree. I thought that was a very mundane, stupid question.
And then there's a talk show. There's a talk show about the talk show. You know, yeah. I think Ben raised a really good point in his talk show about, you know, how Jack had, you know, that disagreement with him. Well, I disagree about Ben's disagreement.
I mean, it's at this point, I feel like already crossed the line into Monty Python, where they had the there's a sketch about like someone seeking a service that's disagreement or contradiction, right? And so you can like go down this hallway and walk into a room and there's someone who offers these different services, and the guy is like trying to find one that's an argument, and he goes in and is like trying to start this argument with the guy, and the guy just keeps saying, no, it isn't. He says, look, all you're doing is contradicting me. And he's like, oh, that's what this is supposed to be. I'm contradiction. And he goes, oh, I'm here for an argument. He goes, oh, that's town hall. What I was going to say, though, also, is that it would lead to some really interesting, like, the way that athletes are endlessly ranked, right? Just both by the nature of the competitive sport that they're in, or scores, you know, where they place, all that kind of stuff. And so, like for our jobs, you know, there'd be a international ranking of mechanical engineers, right? And you could move up and down the rankings, and there'd be somehow you'd try to have to create some stats to determine what moves you up and down the rankings.
First pass yield.
Patents.
Yeah, Pat, that's a good one. I would say salary, maybe like grade level. Are you like a engineer? Are you a senior engineer? Are you a staff engineer? So kind of like your that's not really a role level, maybe rank, but no, you could do, rank is something else.
What do we call it? Like supplemental degrees or certifications or membership and professional organizations.
Which school you went to? I know that plays a big role for people coming out of college.
I mean, it'd almost be like if you take some of the criteria that companies use for hiring or you know, pre-interview preparation, but then just continue that on. So like everybody maintained their, however they were scored during their interview, and then you update that and build that over time as you continue to build your resume.
Hey, actually, I'm going to take a little bit of a tangent here for the podcast namesake.
Impermissible.
Okay, I remember when I went to college, or more specifically when I was, you know, thinking about where to go for college, there was a pretty heavy emphasis on if you want to go into schooling for X, here are the best schools. You should really try to get into those because they're the best, and you'll have a better chance of getting hired if you graduate from there or from one of those rather than just some podunk college that you can get the same degree in, but it's not a very popular school. However, after I was in college, never heard of that again. Not once anywhere.
Yeah. Ever.
And I was just thinking to myself, like, maybe is that just a myth that they tell people applying to college? Because, you know, why not add more stress to their decision?
Right.
But also I realized, you know, I've never been a part of any hiring process. Never interviewed somebody. I've never been a manager to hire people. Maybe those concerns are only really at their level. And I know you've been involved in interviews and stuff, right?
Yes. Yeah, I have.
And recruitment and stuff. So I'm not asking if you care about the you know, which school they're coming from, but have you seen in the hiring process, you know, people on the hiring side of the situation, do they care?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it can depend based on the organization. And so I would say this much, like in my experience, the which schools are best part of that is handled outside of the recruiters. So like for me, we have a selected pool of schools that are already considered, I don't know what you want to call it, acceptable, right?
Preferred, maybe?
Preferred, acceptable, whatever. And so we only recruit there. And that's kind of what draws the boundary line of, okay, this is good or this isn't good, right? And so by the time it gets to me actually talking to a student, 99% of the time I'm talking to students from the same school. But in the case that I'm not, like I've helped in the past with like Big 10 career fairs or Big 12 career fairs. And those are, I mean, sure, you can go look at the rankings and you can see one of these schools is 42nd and one's 46th or whatever, but they're in the same strata, right? Like it's not like they're wildly different.
Sure. But that's recruiting. What about like if there's just an external job posting and then you get applicants from, let's say, all over the country, which is going to be a, you know, that's going to get more and more frequent with the more and more we shift towards remote working. Are the hiring managers going to say, you know, these two guys' resumes and, you know, they, I feel like they're pretty darn comparable, but, you know, applicant A went to this school, applicant B went to this other school. I'm going to go with applicant B because that school is better or more prestigious. Yeah. You know, is that a factor? Or at least let me rephrase that. Is it an important factor?
I would say this. So first of all, I haven't dealt a lot with external hires. I've been involved a little bit in interviewing some contractors and stuff and giving feedback. But I would say that which school you went to in engineering circles would primarily only be a factor for a new hire, or sorry, not a new hire, an early career hire. And only then would be maybe a consideration if you've got two candidates that are super close and you need a tiebreaker or something like that. I haven't been in a situation where it's like typically a driver, unless it's a school that's just like absolutely top tier in engineering for some reason. But then again, like even if you go to a top tier school, there's situations where it's like, man, why is a person from this program applying for a job here? Like, it seems like they should be applying, you know, somewhere with a better opportunity or something, you know what I mean? Like that school is more known for.
Yeah.
First, it does raise a lot of questions in that regard, but in my experience, it's a very, very marginal factor. It seems like where it's more of a factor is when you get into like the smaller circles of elite schools that are politically connected or financially connected, where it's, you know, getting a job is really about who you know, right? And who will put in a recommendation for you versus just the broad swath of, you know, applying to hundreds of jobs online, like people might be doing today.
Right. But that's probably, you know, the vast majority of job applicants throughout the country are not going to fall into that pool.
Right. Yeah. And I think in those cases, the where did you go to school might actually be just a proxy for who do you know or what are your connections, right? It might not be the fact that you went to Harvard. It might be the fact that someone in the fraternity there has a connection with the person who's hiring or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So it's not the school itself. It's the fact that you met people through the school who have the connections that you need.
Yeah. And, you know, your recruitment story, I think, probably brings up a more useful, I don't know if metric's the right word, for people who are thinking about going to college. But like, for example, if you really wanted to work for an agricultural company, like, you know, like we do, like John Deere or Case or something, or a CAT, which is an agriculture, but, you know, heavy machinery, then figure out, and I don't know how somebody, particularly who's like a high school student looking to get into college, would do this, but figure out where they recruit from. Like, if you already have like a company or at least an industry you want to get into, figure out where the companies in that industry are recruiting from, then go to that school, regardless of how prestigious that school is. Granted, yeah. If it's a bigger company, or if a lot of companies in the same industry are recruiting from the same handful of schools, or at least if there is a school common across all companies in an industry that are, you know, getting that students are getting recruited from, it's probably going to be prestigious. But point being is, if you know which industry you want to get into, figure out where that industry is recruiting from and then go to one of those colleges, and don't worry about how prestigious or expensive or whatever it is, because that's not really I've never seen it be a factor. You're saying it in your experience, it's not really a factor either. For example, yeah, I went to the U of M and in Minneapolis.
That's Minnesota for the
anybody who isn't privy to the correct acronym. I went to the U of M in the Twin Cities, Minnesota, and the Twin Cities is the mecca of medical devices, at least in the United States. So U of M, there's so many hiring companies there at, you know, recruit or at job fairs that are medical devices. Certainly not all of them, but a lot of them. And I know when I was in my senior design class, there were 25 projects that the students got to pick from, like which project you want to be a part of. Out of those 25, 15 of them were medical devices.
Yeah.
So if you want to get into the medical device industry because you think that's just really cool, go to the U of M. If you want to go to into the, again, like heavy machinery industry, I know Purdue, John Deere recruits from there. I would bet, do you see a lot of CAT representatives there, Case?
At Purdue?
Yeah.
Yeah, the career fairs I've been to, there's really all heavy equipment manufacturers, automotive manufacturers, aerospace. Those are the big ones. There have been a handful of like railroads or like shipping companies, that kind of stuff. But neat. Yeah, that's pretty neat.
That's pretty neat.
Also, that your story about how many of the senior design project options were medical devices reminded me of a story from my senior design project, which was I think at the fall of our junior, or sorry, the spring of our junior year, the guy that was planning to do senior design partner with me, we were starting to kind of look around for some opportunities and see what was out there amongst the faculty, if there's anything, you know, on their radar that we could jump on with. And we were told, yeah, there's a professor in the electrical engineering department who has an idea that he wants to have vetted with people who are more mechanically minded, and so he could pitch it to you. We're like, okay. So this professor was known for being a little odd, like a always wearing sandals kind of person, like hiking sandals.
And, oh, that's too bad.
And like picking his nose in conversations with you. And
that's almost as bad.
So very interesting idiosyncrasies. Anyway, we get to his office and he starts explaining his idea to us, which was he had like a very rough prototype that he'd made, which was essentially to make a portable gym in a briefcase that you could take with you on work trips to use in like a hotel or wherever you're traveling. And the premise of it basically was that the briefcase would open up and that would become like your seat or stool or whatever, but inside of it, it could carry, you know, weights and some other things for doing workouts. And my partner and I just were kind of like looking at each other and listening to this pitch. And then he got done with the pitch and was like, okay, let us think about it. We'll talk it over and get back to you. And we walked out and was like, has he never seen a hotel gym? Like, it's like what you're trying to invent doesn't need to be invented because like most hotels already cover this possibility by having a gym for people to use.
Well, I have a rather extensive experience. Granted, it's getting a little probably outdated now. It's now coming up on 8 years old, but an extensive experience with mid to low level hotels, and very few of them had gyms. But those were not the gyms where if you're going on a business trip, your company is likely going to put you up in. Your company is likely going to put you up in like a Comfort Inn or a Holiday Inn, maybe like on the higher end. And they probably will have gyms, or at least there's a good chance that they will.
Yeah. And I mean, it doesn't take much of a gym to beat what you can carry in a briefcase.
Yeah.
Not to mention the fact that the whole concept is like briefcases haven't been a thing for years already. So if anything, you're talking about like a backpack or a duffel bag or something, right?
Right.
And yeah, it was pretty much a doomed from the start idea. So needless to say, we did not choose that as our project to sign on with.
A backpack wouldn't be bad because then you could have, you know, more space, more weight. The backpack's already amorphous, so you can probably, you know, have a more awkward shape about it to fit, you know, bigger or awkwardly shaped things than a briefcase. Plus, a briefcase, like, if you start putting weights in there, you're walking around with a heavy briefcase, which is going to suck because you're carrying it in one hand and all that weight's on one side of you, so it's going to be awkward to carry long distances.
And so here's the other thing. What I would do now, if he pitched that, is I'd be like, oh, I can do you one better. We're going to put a portable gym into a credit card. And he'd be like, what? And then I would just pull out like a membership card for Gold's Gym or Planet Fitness or something and be like, unless you're traveling somewhere really remote, if your hotel doesn't already have a gym, there's probably a place in town that you could go work out if you've got a membership or get a day pass or whatever.
Yeah.
And especially it's like if you're traveling too, you know, you now got to carry your gym with you in your luggage or not. I mean, by air, right? You got to check it or try to squeeze it into a compartment somewhere.
Listen to us just bashing this poor guy's idea that he probably thought was pretty cool, but it does show It does show the need for just having a cool idea doesn't mean that it's marketable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the step one is, for everybody who has an idea of something that could work, step one needs to be go get feedback, right? And I think you would find out pretty quickly, like, it's happened to me before. I've told people about ideas that I have, and they're like, oh, that already exists. And I'm like, oh, really? And I look it up, and yeah, sure enough, there's something out there that already does what I thought would be a novel, unique thing, right? Which isn't to say I couldn't still pursue it and do it a different way, but yeah, you got to get it out there and kick it around, not immediately launch into prototyping and trying to recruit people to build it for you.
Yep.
I mean, you can. It just means you're probably going to waste a lot of time and money.
Yeah, it's a big risk. You need to do that market research, which I hate saying those words, but you need to do it. Granted, I mean, if you do the market research, you can end up learning a lot of stuff.
Yep. And I honestly, I enjoy it. I think it's a fascinating process. You learn a lot. And if you have an open mind, or your organization has an open mind, you can find opportunities that you weren't even looking for, right? You've got an idea or something that you're hoping to bring to market. You go out and start talking to people and realize they want something totally different, which you then understand probably better than anybody else in the world, because market research can be expensive. And especially in any given industry, there aren't that many people doing it. And so it really gives you an opportunity to capitalize on some of that learning if you're paying attention. So how the heck did we get there? We were talking about...
I can't remember. Oh, it started with... How did we get there? Oh, I think because, like, one of the things we were talking about when it came to, you know, jobs. No, we were talking about, you know, if people ranked just regular everyday employees like they do athletes, going back to the original topic. I wondered if college, like the prestige of the college you went to, would be a factor in how you were ranked. And then we got into the, wait a minute, is that really even a thing that people pay attention to nowadays? And then that's how we got onto that long tangent.
So that brings me back to a thought that I had, which is the real question would be not to ask college recruiters, but mid-career recruiters, because I know companies go out there and are aware of who the experts in the industry are and are, you know, trying to quote unquote steal somebody from one company to their company based on their known expertise. And so I'd be curious to know, is that all just a word of mouth and intuition thing? Do they look at how many patents somebody has or what their career progression has been? Or how do they, you know what I mean? Like, how do they identify someone who's worth trying to entice away from another company?
Oh, yeah. I think I've wondered that too. And I'm guessing this is pure speculation for me. I'm guessing that really they're, for every one person they identify as, you know, we got to get this guy, he's an expert in this field, there's probably 10 times as many people just as knowledgeable about them. Well, let me rephrase this. I think there's one of two things going on. Either there are 10 times as many people as knowledgeable and as valuable as this person that they have targeted, but they're just unaware of them, because you're right. How do they find out? Their efficiency at tracking these people down is likely low, is my guess. That's scenario one. Scenario two is that these people who are experts in such a niche thing that, one, there just isn't a lot of development going on in that thing. And so the people who are working on that thing get a lot of limelight.
Yeah. I think it would be possible to, like, there's enough. If you're involved in an area of expertise, you start to see like who's publishing things. You start to know, like, okay, these institutions are on the cutting edge, they're at the forefront. You know, you attend conferences where you hear someone speak and you're like, oh, that they're doing something really cool, right? So I think you probably start with that. And, you know, people, if you ask your organization, like, okay, who in this field is the authoritative expert, or, you know, who are the top five that we should go after, you could probably get recommendations that would get you in the ballpark that you could then back up with some additional, you know, checks, I guess I would say. But that's only at the tippity top of, you know, the cream of the crop in any given field.
Tippity top of the cream of the crop.
Yeah. It's going to be the opening line of my new rap song, Best of the Best. That's the title. It's a working title. But anyway, so that's, yeah, I guess that's true though for sports, right? The ones that we see are only the tippity top of the cream of the crop for the most part.
Yes.
If they're professional and televised, there's a lot of people out there who are mucking around doing adult rec leagues that are not getting paid.
I did actually want to bring that up.
Well, here's your intro.
Well, thank you, sir. So, and this applies to the, you said, like, you know, there's, I don't think you've mentioned in this episode yet, but when we were farting around with what topic we're going to cover and we got on this one, you mentioned, you know, one, all the attention they get, all the commentary, but then also a lot of the critique and the criticisms on every little mistake that they make.
Right. Yeah.
So the first part is, you know, what we see, the athletics, or the athletics, the athletes that we do care about, that there is a lot of coverage on, that there are whole talk shows about and press conferences for. These are the cream of the crop. It's not every athlete everywhere who's even getting paid for, you know, even if we just limit it to the professional athletes, or at least athletes that are getting money to play. It's still just a pretty small fraction, I would guess. Mm-hmm. I don't really watch a lot of these sports shows, so I don't know how much of the team they're covering, or if they really are just focusing on like a handful of players out of a 40 plus player team. So that's one factor to consider. If we did, if all jobs were covered like the sports industry is, it would be only a small fraction of the people in that industry who would actually get attention, because that's how it is with sports. And the second point is, you know, these athletes, it's so easy to critique them when they make a mistake, because retrospect's 2020, and we as observers don't realize how hectic, chaotic, spur of the moment, difficult a lot of those decisions are. And of course they're going to slip up. And, you know, I can understand. I understand it wholly, because I remember one time there was a Vikings game where the kicker, this was maybe 10-ish or so years ago, and the kicker, like, missed three field goals. He missed, like, three of three field goals that he took that game. Or he missed – there. It was something like that, or there was, like, a 20-yard field goal for the – at the end of the game, it was at the end of the fourth quarter, and if he made it, the Vikings would have won, but if he missed it, they would lose, because there wasn't enough time to make another play, and he missed it. And I think that, you know, let me retract my previous statement. I want to say that happened like two or three times that season, where he missed like a really easy field goal at really critical moments. And he was a young guy, and you kind of feel bad for him, but at the same time, you know, hey, pay me $1 million. I'll go out there and miss some field goals. You know, why is this guy so special? Yeah. Of course I'm going to critique him. If I were getting the money that guy was getting, then yeah, he better darn well perform. Or I would, you know, I better be expected to perform.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, that's not to say I'm thinking that they can't make mistakes. I think the field goal guy is a bit of a, what's the, a focal point to that argument, because a field goal guy, a kicker, that's all he does. That is the one thing he is supposed to do well. That's the one thing that he has to practice. And if he can't get that one thing right, what the heck are we paying him a professional football salary if he can't do it?
Right.
You know, there are so many other positions, not just in football, in other sports too, where you have to be good at a lot of different things. And if you're not good at one, but you're really good at another, you know, then we have to start, you know, asking questions. Like Shaquille O'Neal. Shaquille O'Neal was a great forward, I believe, but he was terrible at taking shots and even free throws. But that's not why he's on the court. So that's kind of okay.
Yeah, that's a fair point. But there again, like, you know, doing kicking field goals, most of us couldn't even make one field goal, right? We couldn't kick it far enough. We couldn't even probably kick an extra point. It's sure, just,
but
it's an incredibly difficult task that they're being asked to complete. So then the measurement becomes, okay, you can do it. What percentage of the time can you do it? So even in the best of scenarios, an elite, you know, best of the best kicker is still going to miss sometimes. And so it's a question of how often is acceptable, you know, when is a miss tolerable as a kicker, or when is it, you know, a career ending miss? And sure, certainly you would take into that, you know, the significance of the game, you know, when in the game it happens, that kind of stuff. But it's not just, it's not, oh, you missed one, you're done, right?
Yeah, and I don't think it ever should be, because that could have just been a fluke. You know, the whole laces out incident. You screw up one field goal or one kick, and the guy goes crazy, dresses in women's clothing, becomes a police chief to steal the Miami Dolphin. You know, you know, like if you're putting that much pressure on somebody, yeah, they're gonna crack. And I'm not saying that we should, you know, kick them off the team right away. In fact, I'm kind of against that. The Minnesota Twins were really bad about getting young prospects when they're cheap, training them up. They actually start getting good, and then another team buys them up. And I'm very adamant about, it's important to get a team. And I don't know if teams have tried this and it failed, or if there's another mechanic, and I think there is, and I can get to that in a second, if there's another mechanic at play that's preventing a team from getting assembled and them all saying, okay, we're going to stick together for 3 years or 4 years, or maybe even 5 years, and we're going to train together. We're going to learn how to play together and get really good, because we're not switching teams every half season. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to play, the goal being that we're going to learn each other's tactics and become like a whole team, a very effective team, because we know how to play with one another. I would guess basketball and maybe baseball and football would be really good candidates for that. And probably hockey. I would guess basketball would be the most benefit, like the sport that's most benefited from that. That's my guess.
Why do you say that?
Because there's like baseball, everybody's just in their position. You just need to know how to play your position really well. There's not a lot of nuances going on between left field and first base. You know, if you're a good left fielder, you can go on any team and be a good left fielder. Basketball, there's a greater, and the same thing when you're up on the plate. When you're up on the plate, if you're a good hitter, that's really all that matters. It doesn't matter who's ahead of you or who's behind you in the lineup as much as, say, in basketball. Because, like, the basketball is one on offense. You need to know who to get the basketball to at what times and even how. Like, I remember I think this is 10 to 15 years ago, the Minnesota Timberwolves got Ricky Rubio on the team, and he was from Spain. And he was a wizard at getting the ball. What's the team or what's the position? I forget. Point guard. Yeah, I think it was a point guard. So he was really good at staying at the outer fringes and getting the ball where it needed to be. And he had this really cool trick where he'd be looking at one guy and he would like throw the basketball to the side without looking to the guy who it needed to go to, or like behind his back. He was like, it was like a magician doing sleight of hand tricks. It was amazing. And again, I said he came from Spain. I watched the Spanish team play in the Olympics right around the same time. And they were all doing that. It was so fun to watch. And like their ball handling, you know,
that's what she said.
Skills are really good. And that's part of the team dynamic, right? Because you can't do that unless your team knows what you're like, knows that you're doing that stuff. And if you can set up ahead of time a strategy, like you go here, you go there, we'll do this, we'll do that. And then this guy will go in and dunk it or something. You can come up with a strategy. Same thing with football. Baseball, that's not really going on. There's no strategy to baseball. It's hit the ball, or if you're in a position, you know, catch the ball, then get it to where it needs to go as fast as you can.
So what would you say then about what seems to have been the trend in recent years with NBA teams just buying stars? Or you see it even to some extent in football, where some teams have a mentality that you don't have to have great chemistry. You just get the best players together, and it's like a trophy case of talent. And if you've got the most talent on your roster, then you'll win.
I think it's unfortunate because, one, it's just who has the most money. That's who's going to win. End of story. And again, when the Minnesota Timberwolves in that same era, like right, it was right around 2009 to 2012, somewhere around there, they had a really young team. They had just revamped themselves after what I call the Timberwolf Dark Ages, between KG leaving and this era, where they had a lot of young guys and they were trying new stuff and they worked really well as a team. And they were, 2 to 3 years into this dynamic, they started doing pretty well, but then they started losing those players and the team, you can just see the team dynamic eroding away. And they just weren't as effective anymore. So they were an example of, you have a bunch of young, relatively inexperienced players, but because they've figured out how to play together as a team in relatively novel ways, they were more effective than their pay grade would have you believe, which is great because that means that any team has the opportunity if they're, it's about who plays the, it's about, it's not just about who has the most money anymore when that happens. So any team can be good out of the blue.
So bringing that back to the original topic, it reminds me of some training we had at work recently that was examining studies done by Google on teamwork in their projects. And they had studied how teams within Google performed across the span of like 7 years or something like that, and basically found that it wasn't who is on the team that mattered in terms of any kind of demographics or any tangibles, I guess, in that way. It was all about how well the team worked together that determined the outcome. And so the teams that worked together better had better outcomes than, you know, maybe the teams that would have been expected to do better based on, you know, whatever criteria you had up front. And it just kind of, I guess, bringing that concept from sports back to the, you know, professional world, if you will, is, you know, teams that have a great dynamic, that work well together over a period of time, that build rapport, that know what they can expect from their teammates, they are going to perform very highly over a period of time. And you may be able to get, you know, to just buy talent and put them in a room and get good outcomes, but their outcomes are always going to improve as the team dynamic improves. And so even with experts, if they're together for a long time and they have good working relationships, their performance is going to increase over time as they, you know, understand how to work better with each other. So it's, even if you're buying talent, there's no substitute for that team dynamic and building a team that plays or works as a team, right? Like it, you just can't replace that with talent.
Right. I would agree. Real quick though, the study said teams are more effective when, or the team's efficacy scales more with how well the team works together rather than who's on the team and what merits you would think that they would have would make them good workers, right?
Yeah. So specifically, this is part of a series, like a diversity and inclusion series that we've been taking. It's like these, you know, 7 to 10 minute videos that we watch a couple times a month.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah,
I'm familiar. Those over the past several years, the tone of those are like one of the key points that gets hammered away on often is that more diverse teams result in better outcomes, right? So if you've got a team that's got a more diverse background, that has more diverse experience, that has more diverse demographics, that you're going to, in general, statistically, produce better outcomes than a homogenous team. And so that's been something that's been talked about in a lot of these different trainings. So then this most recent one was saying that they basically studied that hypothesis at Google. And so they had teams where that were some that were more homogenous, whether it's male, female, or, you know, ethnicity or whatever. And they had some that were more diverse. And ultimately what they found was that those traits, any of those, I guess, quantifiable traits of an employee, those didn't have any impact on the outcome of the team. It was how well did the team work together, whether it was homogenous or diverse. And did they have a shared vision? Did they, you know, communicate with respect? Did they trust one another? All those kinds of things, right? And it was really independent of who was on the team. It was all about how did the team function as they interacted together.
Okay, that's cool. But so two questions pop up in my brain. One of them is, isn't it sort of a truism to say the most effective teams were the teams that worked best with each other? Like, it seems like, you know, how much money did we pay for you guys to conduct the study, if that was the result? And then two, how do they measure how well they work together? You know what I mean?
Because
we found a trend between how well teams work together and how effective they were. It's okay, we have metrics for how effective they were on the y-axis. What's the metric for they work well together?
Yeah, I don't remember the details. They talked about it briefly, but it was mostly glossed over. And I don't know if that was just because of the brevity of the training or if Google didn't want to disclose their secret sauce or whatever they thought was the true learning behind it. But I think what's not a truism is that there had been such this, there's been a push, I would say, in terms of team building and recruitment, retention, all sorts of things, that if you build a diverse team, you will get better results. That's kind of been the mantra. And what I think their study showed that is not a truism is that that's not necessarily the case. And even teams that work well together that are diverse aren't just going to get better outcomes because of their diversity over other teams that are homogenous and work well together. So it's maybe a truism to say that teams that work well together will get better results. But they were, I guess, able to rule out that you have to have this sort of arbitrary demographic diversity to get better outcomes.
Oh, yeah, I would agree that that isn't a truism. And I would say it was pretty bold of Google to say that. I think I remember this training. I think I watched it last week or right before break. I would say, I mean, that's a pretty shocking revelation. I'm kind of surprised Google would be as bold to say that, because I think that they were on the forefront of, we need to diversify our teams. And now they're saying, never mind. Or at least, well, you know, it's like, hey, this isn't like, we may have overplayed the whole diversity thing.
Yeah, I don't think they're saying never mind, but they were saying, this is not like, if you just inject a bunch of diversity into your organization, you're gonna get these outcomes that you're hoping for, right? It's that all has to. And I guess this comes around to the inclusion part of the acronym, is if people don't feel valued, like they get to contribute, like they're meaningful, that kind of stuff. It doesn't, the diversity piece doesn't mean anything, right? So it's, I think that's what we were talking about, a couple of us, is that the inclusion piece is critical, no matter your workplace, no matter who's on the team, right? Is that, even if it's homogenous, if you don't feel included, the team's not going to function well. You're not going to have good outcomes.
Yeah.
And it's easier for people to not feel included if it's a largely homogenous team and they're the odd person out, right? But you can also have teams that are very diverse that aren't inclusive. And it's all, it takes the team realizing, like, we need to take care of each other to eliminate that sentiment, I guess I would say.
Yeah. Interesting.
So that took another turn.
Indeed.
Well, I kind of feel like we aren't going to have time for the second topic we planned for today.
Shoot. What time are we at right now? Can you tell?
I don't have the running time, but we are somewhere in the ballpark of, I'm going to say, 50 minutes.
Okay. Well, actually, hold on. Yeah, I think we're at 50 or 55. Shoot. Well, how about we do, I mean, we could do a little bit of a, well, I was going to say do a little bit of a preview conversation, but one, I may forget to continue next time. Shoot. I'm okay with going down the path if you are.
Of what, a preview?
Or just of talking about the next topic and seeing where it goes. And we can cut it short if we need to.
Okay, that's fine. You want to kick us off then?
Yeah, I do. Because I'm the one that brought it up. Because it kind of bugged me when I realized it. Okay, so the topic is eggs. And, like, why do chickens and maybe other animals, I think ducks are in the list too, why do they lay unfertilized, wholly developed, not developed into a chick, but, like, you know, big old eggs, like, every day? That way, I'm guessing 5% of their body weight? Like, that's a lot of energy production going into, like, laying these unfertilized, not useful eggs for these birds. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't make any sense. I don't understand how that happened. Like, there's so much of their daily food intake has to go into producing these eggs that if they were in the wild, they would just lay and they would get no use out of them. I don't understand it. Is this something that man cultivated through selective breeding? Or do, like, why, if there are there wild chickens and wild ducks laying eggs every day? I mean, I don't know. I have to look in. It just doesn't make any sense.
It did not make sense. It's the Chewbacca defense.
Now, there might be some of you out there saying, so, well, humans do that too. You know, it's like the menstruation cycle. No, that, well, okay, technically, yes, they do. But, like, think about it. That's a once a month thing. And what is expelled is, I don't even know how small of a fraction of our body weight and caloric intake would go into producing that. But, like, let's say a chicken weighs, let's say an egg is 5% of a chicken's weight. So, like, if you have, like, I don't know if that's true, but I'm guessing it's close enough for the sake of what I'm about to say. That would be like, let's say you have a 120-pound woman. She would be laying what is that?
She'd be having a baby every day, basically.
No, not a fully baby. It would be, like, imagine if like, you know, what her menstruation weighed, like, 7 pounds. And it dropped every day out of her. Like, that is do you realize how much food she would have to eat just to keep that up so that the process didn't starve her?
Yeah, I was just going to what you were saying about, you know, if you said a chicken lays an egg that's 5% of its body weight, that'd be basically like a woman laying a baby every day.
Yeah, it would. Like, that's, yeah, and it would be that much calories. So imagine a woman every day would have to grow. Now, I know, like, in a chicken, there are several eggs developing at a time. It's not like one egg develops, grows, and is laid within the span of a day. There's sort of like an assembly line, as it were, inside the chicken. So, but imagine that, right? Still, on average, their caloric, they'd be producing, their body would be inputting the calories and doing all the work of producing one egg, or in the case of woman, one baby every day. How did the chickens, like, I don't understand how they developed that way. That seems like such a mark. Like, it seems like there's no way evolutionarily that's what happened, because there'd be a chicken that mutated where that didn't happen, and they would be so much more likely to survive. Look how much food chickens would have to scrounge just to keep this useless process in their bodies up and running, because that process would keep going. Oh, that process would keep going until that, like, until it starved the chicken.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
I don't get it.
I was just doing a little bit of reading, and the answer seems pretty emphatically that chickens wouldn't do that in the wild, that it's been selective breeding over thousands of years that's caused chickens to lay so many eggs.
Oh, thank God. That makes so much more sense.
But it also, this article I found said that even the most prolific egg-laying hens only produce like 310 a year. So even they can't keep up every single day levels of production. It's too draining. So there's some, you know, there's some breaks built in when their body's just like, nope, not laying eggs because I don't have the energy for it, basically.
Okay. Makes a little bit more sense. And I also heard when we were having this conversation at group, I think it was Lonnie who said, well, if you leave the egg in the nest, the chicken will stop producing eggs. There's some trick where if the egg isn't present, if they lay an egg and then you take the egg out of the nest, there's something in their brain that triggers, oh, I gotta make another egg. And if you just do that every day, that trigger never gets untripped.
Right. Yep. That was another thing that showed up, was that they're basically laying eggs until they get a clutch, which is around a dozen, and then they would stop laying eggs and just incubate them, basically. So they don't, their long-term memory, I guess, is not good enough to realize they're just being robbed. And so they're like, oh, get up in the morning, like, oh, got to start a clutch, and lay an egg. And then the next morning, they're like, oh, got to start a clutch. It's just, they never get past that point of like, oh, this isn't getting me anywhere. It's just starting a clutch new every day.
Well, that's the thing. They're probably not even thinking that far. It's some subconscious thing in their brain that's doing all the work.
Yeah.
They don't realize that their eggs
are gone. I know what you mean. Anthropomorphizing, but yes.
But still, the fact that they lay, that they inside them grow to term, as it were, whole unfertilized eggs is pretty crazy. Like, I don't, like, any animal that doesn't lay an egg, I can't even think, like, you know, humans or a cat or a dog, right? They have live births. I can't even imagine what the analogy to that would be. Like, if their body were like, well, the egg isn't fertilized, but we're going to keep growing half of a baby on that egg and bring it to,
yeah,
quote unquote, term, and then birth it out, even though it's just maybe a bunch of, oh, I don't even want to think what that would be.
Yeah, that's all of the caloric investment is made without any guarantee that it gets fertilized in the end, right?
Yeah, so it's all the caloric investment but that caloric investment isn't triggered by it being fertilized like it is in mammals. They right. don't, their yeah. bodies don't start building the flesh onto and supplying nutrients to the egg unless it's been fertilized. The fact that chickens, and I'm guessing many other birds and maybe even lizards or other egg-laying animals, the fact that their bodies don't have that trigger, to me, seems like a evolutionary bug. Like, how did that not get worked out via evolution?
It's a good question. And I think this has made me think of another topic for a future episode. Maybe we could talk... We could talk about the unnatural human influence on our food production systems, right? So the fact that a chickens lay so many eggs compared to what they would lay in the wild, or, you know, even looking at plants that aren't genetically modified, in quotation marks, but that have been selectively bred for, you know, hundreds if not thousands of years to produce bigger apples or more flavorful grapes or whatever it might be, right? All those kinds of things. Could be interesting to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it could. And sort of like the, you know, man's role in manipulating nature. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it neutral?
And for those who are trying to escape it, like, can you actually, right? Like, how far back do you have to go to find something that hasn't, to find an animal or a plant that hasn't been changed by its cultivation for human consumption?
Cats. Cats are way too stubborn to have been changed by humans.
Yeah. So we should start eating cats now? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying eat them. They're just an example of something that humans haven't really been able to alter. Although I have heard that's actually, well, it's true, but not for the reason, the asinine reason I gave. It's just because cats have not been, have been domesticated far, far, they were first domesticated much more recently than dogs. So dogs have just had more time to get selectively bred and yada, yada. And well, of course, then the question becomes too, like, if you want, like, can you escape human manipulation of nature? But do you really want to? Because there's a reason why selective breeding started. And that's because you can get more food out of a unit of corn, or out of a unit of grain, or out of a unit of chicken.
Right. I mean, if you're really trying to escape all human influence on plant and animal, you essentially become a hunter-gatherer, right? Like, that's your only real option. Because as soon as you start, even if you were able to find, you know, an unadulterated maize plant from before humans started selectively breeding them, as soon as you start raising them, the process just begins again, right? And so you can kind of reset it, but it's going to continue all over again. Unless you're like, oh, you know what? I'm not going to look for the plants that had the produced the most corn. I'm going to look for the plants that produced the most average amount of corn. And then we'll try to keep things as static as possible. But even that's a form of human intervention, because who's to say that the plants wouldn't have naturally become more productive or less productive or whatever over time.
I think what you'd have to do is have like a whole collection of some plant or some animal, and to avoid selective breeding, you have to do one of two things. You either pick the ones like grain, for example, right? You just pick grains out of random ears of maize, and then plant those. And so theoretically, you're getting every planting, you're just getting a random assortment of genes from the previous crop. And on average, it's probably going to more or less stay the same. Or what you do is, I guess it's a similar effect, although it's much less efficient, is you have, let's say, 10 acres of corn. And or of maize, but that's the thing, right? You probably can't just plant them in an environment that isn't natural to them. So what you'd really have to do is go out, just find maize plants naturally throughout the area, and then you're only harvesting grain from 10, 20, 30% of them, and you're allowing the other remaining plants to drop their seeds and grow new plants, and then you just keep that cycle going and going and going, and then you're just sort of like letting nature grow as unadulterated as you can while also getting food from it. But that's so inefficient, because you, for every 10 acres of plants that you would have spread out throughout the area in little pockets wherever maize plants grow, you'd only be able to harvest 1, 2, 3 acres worth of grain. which
well,
is
that's pretty neat.
That's pretty you can, neat.
You can tell it's maize because of the way it is.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
So
anyway,
I think we can, and this go. I think it's related to the topic we had a few episodes ago, which was human intervention and why people are trying to stop it. You know, is it a big deal if humans are changing the planet, or are we just the next thing that evolution has to account for? Like, why is it okay that evolution had to? Why is it okay and natural that evolution had, and animals and plants had to adapt to the little ice age so many years ago? Why is that okay? But all of a sudden, when we're introducing climate, you know, change or renovating the landscape, oh, well, no, plants and animals shouldn't have to adapt to that. Why not? Why are we different?
Yeah, I mean, from that perspective, it's almost like evolution produced itself, right? It produced a random process characterized by mutations, developed a species capable of non-randomly generating interactions between mutations.
Mm.
So in that sense, like, just from a philosophical perspective, you could argue that humans are the pinnacle of evolution because we're able to improve upon evolution by increasing the utility significantly more rapidly than a natural process.
We are the order out of chaos.
Yeah.
But
you could also argue that that makes us the least natural species because we're able to manipulate something that nobody else can in that way, right?
But no, why is that unnatural though? Because if we came about through natural selection and evolution, and so unnatural is a contradiction in terms. That's not unnatural processes don't exist.
No, I'm saying from the perspective that everything else in nature, or no other species in nature, is able to productively manipulate other species to increase their utility for themselves, to my knowledge. Right.
Well, now there
is. In that way, it makes us unnatural that we're completely different from other species.
But I don't think that's a good metric for if something's natural or not.
No, I mean, I always kind of chuckle when it's like we talk about synthetics or artificial compounds or whatever. It's like, okay, it's not naturally occurring, but it's still made out of natural substances, right? Like every chemical is comprised of elements that exist in nature. So it kind of depends on what your definition is and how far you break it down.
Right. Right.
Unless you somehow build something, well, even if you built something out of, you know, some rare element that we don't have on the planet that came from a meteorite or a comet or whatever, right? It still existed somewhere in the universe.
Oh, technetium, I think it's called. There's a random element in the periodic table. Because I think if you or the listeners remember back to the elemental or the periodic table, all the radioactive stuff is kind of grouped together on like the lower, heavier elements. There's one element like smack dab in the middle of the table all by its lonesome that's radioactive. The element right before it isn't radioactive. The element right behind, right after it isn't radioactive. In fact, there's no other radioactive element for like, you know, I think does like at least a dozen or two of items up the list. But this one random element in the middle of the table is radioactive. And it's called technetium. I think it's technetium. I think it's TE or TC. And we haven't found any natural occurrences of it because it's all decayed away. So that could be one. That could be, Ben, the one unnatural element that we could find in a meteor or something.
TE or TC? I don't see that. Oh, TC. Yeah. Technetium?
Maybe
43. It's the lightest element whose isotopes are all radioactive.
There we go.
One of the transition metals.
Medium, yeah. TC, yeah, there we are.
Also, I didn't know this. Google now has a built-in visualizer for the periodic table. So it has its own result. And then you can click on any of the elements and it shows you the atomic model for it with the protons, neutrons, and electrons in their orbits.
Oh, I lied. We're always wrong. Apparently there are natural occurrences of technetium.
I'm going with the lied part.
Dang.
Because you're never wrong.
Thank you, sir. I like that.
So you'd rather be a liar than wrong?
Maybe, because that still means I'm always right, unless I mean to not be right for my own ends. Yes. But real quick, we probably should end the episode, but I wanted to, like the people who say, you know, synthetics are unnatural and we should avoid them. I think what they're getting at is if it's not a chemical that we find in nature, if we like would pick up an apple off of a natural apple tree and eat it, or you know it's in naturally in beef or it's naturally in whatever, our bodies or the environment around us, whether it's food or just some random chemical we use for like herbicide or something or paint, and it gets into the environment or it gets into our bodies, the environment and or our bodies don't know what to do with this new chemical, and so it could cause dangerous side effects because of that, or at least you know unknown side effects, and that's why quote-unquote unnatural or quote-unquote synthetic things are dangerous. I can see where they're coming from that perspective. However, if you have a synthetically created chemical that is otherwise found naturally, I don't see what the problem is with that. Like synthetically, I don't know if this is a thing, but let's say synthetically generated sugar. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think the kind of the logic behind it is that if it exists in nature, then nature has a tolerance for it or an immune system to deal with it, or right, there are mechanisms for interacting with that substance. Whereas with something that's synthetic, maybe it's fine, but we don't know. And I think it would be interesting at a high level if it were possible to quantify, like, you know, if you developed a synthetic toxin or something, is it inherently more dangerous because there's no natural way to build up your immune system to interact with it, right? Could it be something of equal, what's the word I'm looking for? Like equal mortality rate as a naturally occurring virus, or that's not the right terminology. Anyway, you get what I'm getting at. Like two things that are equally potent, but the synthetic one has a stronger effect because there's no natural way to be exposed to it and to potentially build up a defense against it.
Well, I think that's part of the potency thing. So I think it's difficult. I think if you have two toxins or viruses or whatever that are quote unquote equally potent, that right there solves the question, or that is the answer. Then no, the synthetic one isn't more dangerous because it's equally as dangerous as the naturally occurring toxin or virus or whatever. I think it being novel and there being no safeguards or tolerances for it is what causes the thing to be dangerous.
Yeah.
If it has a negative effect, you know, there could be some synthetic chemical that gives everybody superpowers. I wouldn't call that dangerous. Well, I would, but not because it's chemically toxic.
It's the X gene, right? Or what do they call that in X-Men?
I don't know. I haven't seen an X-Men movie for like one or two decades.
Oh, I think it's called that. It's the term for the like super mutant gene. I'm gonna look it up. Yeah, the X gene.
Hmm.
Not the X chromosome. Very different.
Yes. Well, do we call it here?
I think so. I think we've successfully covered the topics we set out to cover, gave ourselves some new ideas for next time.
Yep.
We can flesh out a little bit more. Or maybe not next time, but at some point in the future. So as always, we love hearing from you. If you got feedback, if you have ideas, if you want to be a guest caller, I think we're getting more stable in our technological ability to do that. So we certainly would be willing to try to make something happen, figure out our schedules and
yep,
get together. So
I was going to say, too, we've had, it was recently brought to light to us that there's a noise or a sound level difference between myself and Ben. So I tried moving my mic a little bit further away from my mouth. I have a headset with a mic on it. So let us know if the quality isn't still, or if the sound levels aren't satisfactory too, because that's something that we can work on. And it's something that, you know, I don't listen to the podcast ever. I do want to change that. If we can get specifically to catch things like this, if we can get the podcast up on Pocket Casts. Ben, I don't know if you listen to the episodes after.
I do periodically, yeah.
Okay. We probably should do that on the reg just so we can quality check them.
I mean, I listen to snippets of each segment as I'm editing it to publish, which is usually just trimming the start and end.
Mm.
But I've much less frequently listened to an episode that's already been published, although yeah. I will periodically.
I think one time my friend said there was something wrong with our inputs, and I think my input was delayed because your input was delayed because he kept thinking, wow, Jack's a jerk. He keeps talking over Ben. I started talking before you stopped talking, but he realized one time that, wait a minute, Jack started answering a question or talking about something that Ben hadn't even mentioned yet. And then that's when it clicked. Oh, there's something wrong with the inputs being out of sync. So
yeah,
that was just one episode a while ago. I think
that was pretty early on when, like, one of the first times that we did recorded remotely where we weren't in the same room. And I suspect it was like an internet glitch or something that got us out of sync. But I am looking at some upgrades to both hardware and software in the future that would let us do more quality control type stuff like that.
Cool beans.
So keep your ears peeled. Is that a phrase? Keep your eyes peeled. Keep your ears open.
Don't peel your ears. I mean, it kind of worked out for Van Gogh, but.
Did it though? I mean, he's famous for it, but I don't think he won over the woman he was trying to, did he?
What a shock.
You mean a chunk of ear didn't do it for you?
Gets on one knee, honey. Lady. Like, oh, is that a ring? No.
Yeah, I'll be right back.
Or like he gets on one ring, honey. Is that a ring? What?
If only cutting off part of your earlobe had that dramatic of an impact on your hearing.
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, folks, and we will catch you next time. Take care. Yeah.